There's one thing to have a policy, and many companies have a policy. You can look at their integrated reporting and it says, you know, we pay attention to human rights and we do all this. But the key is there actually any mechanism underneath that, any framework that actually shows that we are actually proactively doing something?
Human trafficking doesn't always take the form we first imagine. It can be found at almost any level of an organization's supply chain. What can compliance professionals do to assess human trafficking risk, and how can they leverage the resources of the organizations they work for to help root out this tragic problem? Gwen Hassan is here to help. This is Hidden Traffic.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Hidden Traffic. I am your host, Gwen Hassan, and I'm really excited today to have Ben Foraker with me. Ben is the Managing Director and Global Investigations Lead for Asia, Pacific, and Japan. It's a very long title, Ben, for JS Held Company out of Tokyo. Welcome, Ben. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here. Thank you very much.
So let's start with a little bit of background about you. Tell our listeners about who you are, how you became interested in global investigations, and how you ended up working in Japan.
Okay, well, it's a long story, so I'll try and make it as brief as I can. So I am originally from the UK. I moved to Japan about 16 years ago. And when I moved, I was moving with a UK-based consulting firm that was essentially doing strategic consulting. Okay. So helping companies to align behind strategies and execute those strategies. So part of that was practical strategic planning and execution. And part of that was more around what kind of behaviors are required to actually drive those strategies and get things done. So I moved to Japan, arrived kind of on my fingernails thinking, well, I can do this, but soon realized that Japan is a very different market to the UK, obviously. And I spent 6 years working with non-Japanese, non-Asian companies, so foreign Western companies mainly, traveling around the Asia-Pacific region, doing these facilitating workshops, facilitating these strategy sessions. So I had a lot of exposure at the time to some of the Asian markets, countries such as China, Vietnam, Indonesia, and so on. And this was, you know, over 16 years ago, and a lot has changed, I have to say, since 16 years ago. Some of the challenges are still very relevant to today. The challenges of trying to establish a business, trying to engage with stakeholders, trying to provide positive and, I guess, influential business operations and so on, and also look after employees and understand different cultures and different regulations and so on. So I spent a lot of time doing that. I then moved to a company which was a US-based consulting firm, partially because I wanted to be more focused on Japan.
Okay.
And the role was very much based in Japan, working for Japanese companies. And that was where I moved more into the risk and investigations market. So predominantly since that time, I've been working on what we call risk and investigations, which, to summarize that, it's a mixture of proactive and reactive work. So proactive being trying to identify issues and mitigate risks before we get into trouble, and reactive being, you know, how we deal with the challenges when they actually occur and the problems that come up, how we respond to those challenges. And a lot of the work we do for risk and investigation is really about gathering information, analyzing that information, and helping companies to make decisions based on that information. Of course, with risk and investigations, you're protecting corporate value, you're protecting corporate enterprise, but you're also working with individuals to try and understand what makes us do certain things, how we behave in certain ways, and, you know, working with companies to try and obviously motivate and influence people to do the right thing. Now, during that time, we've always worked on supply chains. We've always worked on labor issues. We've looked at environmental issues. We've looked at employee relations issues and so on. I would say the biggest focus we've seen in Asia, what drives this, has been foreign regulation, FCPA obviously being one of those. And, you know, when I first started doing this in Japan, we did many, many seminars talking about what is FCPA? Why should it matter? What is a government official?
Why should you care as a Japanese person what the US says? Yeah,
quite, exactly. Yes. But obviously, we've seen issues where Japanese companies have fallen foul of those regulations, and then suddenly it becomes a big deal. And suddenly companies have compliance departments, they do training, and everybody's aware now of what is a government official, what is bribery, what is corruption. And although it's still an issue, it's a lot better understood. I think what we've seen since that time, certainly in the past 3 to 4 years, is companies moving towards sustainability. And with sustainability comes a whole agenda of ESG issues, disclosure issues, ethical issues, and so on. And as we've seen more recently, regulation, legislation is moving forward very quickly too. And I think that companies have aligned themselves behind these sustainability goals and have branded themselves as sustainable organizations. But many aren't really aware of what actually that means we have to do as a company. So in the last 2 to 3 years, we've been focusing very strongly on the social side of ESG, the social impact. I think that the environmental side is largely focused on when people talk about sustainability, a lot of people think about climate change, emission reduction, and so on. In a way, I wouldn't say it's easy, but it's more understandable in terms of how we can gather data and report on that, because a lot of that is quantitative data. Yeah. And it follows financial reporting methodologies. Social impact is harder to measure and it's harder to define because it's a lot more qualitative in terms of the data we're gathering. And a lot of the time, the data isn't there. So when we start talking about companies being responsible for their supply chains, to be honest, not many companies really know what their supply chains are. They may have relationships with tier one suppliers, but beyond that, it's rather less transparent. So what we've been doing is we've been trying to work with companies on implementing a human rights due diligence process, understanding what is our social risk, what is the impact across our entire value chain, how do we try to figure out where we're most at risk, where we're doing most damage to social communities, people, employees, whatever it may be, but looking at that whole spectrum of things that's covered and, you know, developing ways to investigate, developing ways to dig into the issues, developing ways to map out our suppliers, developing ways to communicate our objectives with those suppliers, with our customers, with our value chain, and then looking at how what role we play in terms of remediation, you know, how we can contribute positively to society as an organization. So there's a big change that's taking place, I think, will continue to do so as companies move more towards this, almost more towards an ethical standpoint. And obviously, the more ethical you present yourself as a company, the more scrutiny you will be under from customers, investors, shareholders, NGOs, etc. So that's essentially, you know, what we've been focusing on. Of course, we've been working with several Japanese companies on this. And I have to say, it's incredible how fast this is being picked up and implemented and how serious many companies are taking this. Considering the time, I guess, regulations and legislation has moved very quickly. Normally things don't happen so quickly in Japan, but this has been picked up very proactively. And, you know, I honestly think that this is a big part of, you know, what we'll be looking at in terms of leadership, in terms of responsibility going forward.
That's fantastic. I read recently, I'm probably going to butcher these, so forgive me in advance, but it's the Ministry of Economy, Trade and Industry. Do they call it METI or METI?
METI, yes.
Okay. And the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Japan, MOFA. This cracked me up, actually. I laughed out loud when I read it because it said they conducted a survey that revealed that 1 out of 5 companies in Japan currently don't have guidelines or safeguards related to human rights protection in their supply chains. And I thought, wait, does that mean that 4 out of 5 do? Because if so, man, they're way ahead of what I'm seeing in terms of US companies and even European companies for that matter. So do you have the perception that Japan's kind of setting the curve now in terms of this?
Yeah, put me on the spot there. I don't think that's the case. I think there are some very good examples of Japanese companies that are ahead of the curve. I think that what we have to understand, though, is the differences in geographical businesses and domains and the types of risk profiles we have.
So, for instance, the scope of the company.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, looking at it from, so for instance, if we talk about human rights to a largely, I would say, middle class audience in Japan, what they'll generally associate this with is diversity and inclusion, which is part of the whole human rights spectrum, of course, and very valid. If we talk about it to companies in the US, is human rights important to you? They will generally think about discrimination, racial discrimination, you know, Black Lives Matter campaigns and so on. If we talk about it to companies in Asia Pacific emerging markets, they're thinking more about having a minimum working wage and making sure that, you know, our working hours aren't so extreme and that we're not forced to do overtime, that we're not paid to do. So there's different perspectives on what human rights is. So I think that's one thing to consider. And when the Japanese government did that survey, I think the reason for the survey was that it preceded their human rights due diligence guidelines. They were trying to raise some awareness of, you know, where are we on this? There's one thing to have a policy, and many companies have a policy. You can look at their integrated reporting and it says, you know, we pay attention to human rights and we do all of this. But the key is there actually any mechanism underneath that, any framework that actually shows that we are actually proactively doing something? And I think that that is where we have to be careful about these surveys. I know I've worked with companies on various policies. You know, in Japan, we have anti-social forces policies, which relate to links with organized crime. Mm-hmm. And every company has to have a policy. And they put it on the website that they will not do business with organized crime and so on. But in actual fact, many companies don't have a mechanism underneath that that actually mm-hmm. prevents that from happening. Yeah. So sometimes they get into trouble. I think with sustainability, and you know, certainly what I get from the US, there's a lot of talk about greenwashing. There's a lot of talk now about the SEC clamping down on companies that are claiming that they're doing all of this, and in actual fact, they're not. One of the biggest criticisms that NGOs have of companies is that they're not doing what they say that they're doing. When we read all these surveys and we see all these companies with accreditations, I think that's all very positive and it's encourageable. However, I think that we have to be a little bit careful about making assumptions. Having said that, Japan is the only country in the Asia-Pacific region that has a human rights due diligence guideline that's been issued by the government. Now, part of the reason for that is, of course, Japan's supply chain is huge, and we rely on foreign countries to provide a lot of our goods. So we're more exposed in a way. Also, Japan is forced to grow into markets outside Japan because the domestic economy isn't growing. It's relatively stagnant. Mm. So I think the exposure level is higher. The risks are higher. And so there needs to be more attention paid to this. Having said that, I will say in Japan, what we have noticed, the guideline issued by the government is purely a guideline. It's not mandatory. It's voluntary. What we do have in Japan, though, is obviously if the government does issue such a guideline, companies will generally accept, okay, we need to do something. And if you do see certain Japanese companies, certainly I notice here we have the trading firms, which are big, diverse, multinational organizations. They seem to be leading the way on this. And okay. Certainly we're doing a lot of work with the trading firms here. Other companies are looking at that and thinking, well, they're leading the way. We should be doing something. For me, it is a very positive move. And I think Japan has always been aware of its stakeholder engagements, its stakeholder responsibilities. It's been doing that very well since the war in terms of its domestic business policies. And now it's looking to see whether we can extend that overseas and almost put down a stake as a role model in terms of this is the way we're going to do business.
Yeah, kind of peer pressure the rest of the world into following suit. Yeah.
Yeah, but having said that, of course, you have companies in the US, you have companies in Europe and the UK, I mean, who are way ahead of the game. I'm not sure if I would ever say anyone has a gold standard program. I mean, there's never going to be 100% perfect operation, but I think there's a lot of guidance, and Japanese companies also want to understand what are US companies doing, what are European companies doing, because certainly in the US, obviously, you have the Forced Labor Prevention Act that's come in, and you know that's a big deal for many companies, because to be honest, it's very hard to trace supply and to actually prove indefinitely that our supply isn't coming from potentially forced labor. So I think all of these issues have become a lot more prominent. So the need for transparency is greater. And I just think, you know, at the moment we're preparing ourselves and trying to figure out, well, what is the best practice? But it's very hard to benchmark because industries are different, operations are different, our geographies are different. So we're all kind of trying to learn from each other at the moment, I think, in terms of what the best approach is.
I know you've mentioned now that these are guidelines only. They don't have the force of law in Japan, but yet they are seen as pretty influential for business, which I think differs a bit from what I think of Europe, where they're all about making things law. And it's not so much, here's some guidelines to follow. We'd like you to think about this. It's more, hey, you have until January 1st to implement this, like the German supply chain law or the new EU human rights law that, you know, is coming out as well. Is there the perception in Japan that there's a timeline behind this, that, you know, we should do this by date certain? Is that included in the guidelines? Or is it just more of a, hey, generally, this is something you should work on?
Yeah, I mean, the guidelines don't say you have to do this by this certain time. And to be honest, I don't see the Japanese government moving with any legislation on this, because we're in a very politically sensitive area when it comes to the Japanese government doing that. You know, I'm aware the US have an entity list, China has their list, and so on. It'd be great for all the governments to put a list together, because that would make things so much easier, but it just won't happen that way. There's no real pressure in terms of you have to do this by this amount of time. But I think that there is pressure from stakeholders in terms of questions being asked by investors, shareholders, customers, employees. You know, what are we doing about this? Where are we on this journey? And what's our position? Because I think, to be honest, the whole sustainability agenda has forced companies to reevaluate their objectives, their vision, if you will, in terms of what is our purpose as a company? What are we setting out to do? We can no longer profit from environmental harm, social harm. We have to be seen to be a contributor. And in order to be a top 500 FTSE or TSE or whatever it is you're going to be, there will be a certain expectation in terms of what policies you have, the drivers for those policies and how you implement them. So I think that generally there is a kind of a feeling that we need to have something in place. You know, obviously what we're telling companies is you can't put your arms around everything in 12 months, 24 months. It's an evolving process, very similar to compliance programs and so on. It changes with the business. I mean, I would say even in the last 6 months, we've seen here in Japan a real scramble in a way to sort of get things in place, or at least have a policy and at least sort of think about how we risk map our business. But honestly, I think it will take several years before we have some real tangible structure around how that works and how to kind of benchmark what we're doing against our peers.
What that looks like. Yeah. When you're starting out with a client in this space, do you normally do that kind of a materiality assessment first to look at the risk profile and kind of where, I know the guidelines use this term adverse human impacts, which is similar to what we see in the European legislation as well. Is that where you start, is looking to see where are this company's highest potential adverse human impacts? Is that a starting
point? Yeah, so it's impossible to put together a policy or a program without understanding your risk. So the same as any strategic approach, you first of all have to start with understanding, you know, where is our exposure? And so the first thing starts with risk mapping the organization. And obviously, if you're looking at a multinational company, you start off with, well, what are our countries of operation? What do we do in those countries? What type of operation? You know, who are we employing? What types of people are we employing? Are we directly involved? Are we contracting? Are we using third parties? So I think, you know, our approach is really, let's look at the countries, let's look at the sector, let's look at the type of operation, and look at how different human rights risks occur in those areas. And then also look at our relationship with those operations. So whether we're direct or indirect or, you know, third parties, whatever, because that denotes the leverage we may have around fixing issues that we find. But the first point of call is very much that. And again, it doesn't have to be too complex. It's a question of understanding from our perspective, what's our big risk exposure? And so we do that. We look at the company's operations to the extent that we can. We would also look at supply. So that involves understanding, well, what do we know about our supply chain? What don't we know about our supply
chain? That's often easier to answer is the what we don't.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, working to fill in those gaps. So many companies will do the risk map and we'll help them with that. And you will end up with a very good idea of where your key issues are. Now, I often compare this to, again, if we go back to FCPA, bribery and corruption issues, everyone's aware of the Transparency International Index. And many companies use that as a kind of a baseline in terms of understanding.
Almost a proxy, for what is that Corruption Perception Index, right?
Now, we don't have something like that for human rights. There are many different types of indexes, many different sectors, specific ones, different NGOs do different ones. But there isn't like a definitive guideline that we would refer to that says this is exactly something that everybody globally can use and align to, for obvious reasons. I mean, it's different issues with different companies and so on. So we basically have to create that for the company and use it as a kind of a living and breathing tool that we can develop as we go through, as the company grows and things change, as regulation changes, as human rights issues change and so on. So that's the first step. And then we would move on to profiling suppliers, risk profiling suppliers. And again, depending on the information the company has on their suppliers, that may or may not be an onerous process.
Yeah.
It's applying some very basic categories to what do we know about those suppliers? How big are they? How many people they employ? What's the volume of goods we get from them? Mm-hmm. What do we know about their employee profiles, the operations? Have they been in trouble before? You know, all of those things that we look at.
Maybe what percentage of business do we represent to them? Which is a
absolutely. And again, you have to take a risk-based approach. We're not necessarily going to be able to cover everything, but we are going to be able to understand where our company is most likely to be exposed to those types of social issues or impacting those social issues. And I think, you know, a lot of those issues, you know, I think what's important through this process is to understand that one company alone may not and cannot be responsible for fixing it. It's just not possible. It always worries me when companies are putting the 17 SDGs on their website and saying, okay, we're going to, you know, solve world poverty. On your own, you cannot do that. And some of these issues are endemic to the countries of operation. So if you talk about human rights issues such as discrimination, such as, you know, discrimination of migrant workers, perhaps, such as long working hours and poor pay, well, we've been taught to squeeze our supply chains, to reduce the margins on our supply chains. For years and years, that's been basically what we've been doing so that we don't pass cost on to the customer and we'd be more profitable. Now we're being told, no, you know, we now need to invest, we need to negotiate with our suppliers. We need them to understand that we're going to be responsible now for the welfare of your social position. So it's a different approach. So trying to understand
that. It's a paradigm shift. Yeah, for sure.
It is very much so.
Yeah.
But often companies don't realize that they're responsible for some of the issues. Some suppliers are putting in, you know, seasonally extremely long working hours and having to bring in temporary labor. Often we realize that that's because the pressure on them to deliver certain goods at a certain time of year is coming from us. So we have to try to figure out, well, are there things that we can influence as a company? Or is it something that we can't influence? Or is it something that maybe we can if we get some help from other parties and so on? So it kind of raises a lot of questions when we run through that process. But obviously the key at the first stage is to understand where are we most at risk from, I guess, being attacked by, you know, stakeholders in terms of them asking questions about, what are you doing about this? Did you know about this? Certainly, of course, child labor, forced labor, those are really prominent issues that we really need to understand. You know, is there any potential exposure to that? Because obviously that's key in terms of all the issues are very extreme and they're very valid. But child labor, forced labor is obviously where companies will be most at risk of reputational damage, financial damage, legal damage.
You took the words right out of my mouth. I was about to say the reputational risk category is so high for those. I mean, not that there's other areas of human rights that aren't equally as important, but I think less likely to end up, you know, splashed on the front page of a newspaper than those two. Child labor and forced labor are such hot button issues.
And I think traditionally, when I spoke at the beginning about the work we do being proactive, reactive, many of these issues in the past and even now have been reactive. They've been raised by NGOs who've raised the issues with companies. And often the companies don't really know how to respond to that. Obviously, the NGO, their job is to raise the issues and be passionate about those issues. Companies immediately put the walls up and start to think, oh, no. But we have social media now. It's easy for you to wake up and see plastered all over social media pictures of children in your supply chain. And companies have no idea, is that true? Is that us? Is that our supply chain? We just don't know. So being able to lead that conversation, be aware of the information that we need, being able to address whether these are things that we should and can respond to, that's very important. I often sort of saying to our clients here that the more you move towards sustainability, the more you also have to understand how to defend your company when questioned. That's not saying that we're trying to cover things up. No, it's being aware of the information that you need to be able to say to people, we're aware of this issue. And we're not responsible, but these are the things we're doing, or we were aware of this issue and we were responsible. And as a result of that, these are the things that we're doing. So that type of
transparency.
That's much more valid now when we're putting ourselves on the line as being more ethical and, you know, socially viable companies. I think we also have to understand how to respond to issues when they come up and when they're raised. But that's a very valid point. And I think NGOs, I'm not sure how companies view them so much in other countries, but certainly in Japan, we're very fearful of NGOs. Mm. They've not typically been organizations that we would be willing to do dialogue with initially. But I think understanding and guidelines in Japan talk a lot about stakeholder engagement. understanding the value of NGOs, understanding how to partner with NGOs, understanding that NGOs don't have the answers necessarily, but they can help us find the solutions if we work with them. I think that's a very important thing for companies to understand. You know, we're encouraging dialogue with NGOs because they spend their time looking at these issues. They know what's going on the ground. They know why certain issues occur in certain communities.
Yeah.
So I'll give you an example. We were working with a factory in one of the Southern Asian emerging markets, and it was a German factory run by a German company, let's say. And it had 1,500 people on site, low-skilled work, so no major work. It's production line things.
Yeah.
But every day, every morning, 7 o'clock, a bus would pull up and the workers would get off the bus and come into the factory. Now, the factory used third-party recruiters to get the workers because obviously to get 1,500 workers a day to run the factory, you need help. So they don't interview every single worker. They don't know who all the workers are. The third party has that information, or at least you assume they have that information. But I remember standing on the factory gate with the general manager in the morning, and we're watching the workers go in, and he's looking for children. He's looking to see whether there's anyone who looks like, yeah, they shouldn't be here. And even though we don't know, we don't have proof, if there's anyone that we suspect, then obviously we need to raise that with the agency that's bringing the people in. And we have to trust that they have the right information, the right documentation. However, one of the eye-openers for me was the reason that children are coming to work at the factory is they have no other means of making a living. And often they don't have parents, or the parents are ill. And without getting paid that week, they won't eat. That's the issue. So as a company, do we say, okay, well, that person can't work here because it's against our policy to have children working here, it's against the law? In which case, are we saying that we're now responsible for the fact that that child won't eat this week, their family won't eat this week? A real dilemma. So how we fix that as a company on our own, we can't fix that endemic issue, but we can contribute to that. And often the contributions will, how we contribute is something that we can work with NGOs on, because they know those issues. And they know, well, perhaps there's food banks, perhaps there's ways that we can figure that out. Perhaps there's help we can give to those families. Mm-hmm. Perhaps there's some kind of healthcare program that we can give to the fathers, the mothers, etc. Yeah, there must be something we can contribute to that kind of helps in a way. It doesn't solve the dilemma, but we can contribute to some kind of positive aspect of that. But I think honestly, when companies start thinking about all of these risks, that sometimes they're just not aware of the reality of why this happens and what's causing this, what's behind it. And that's where NGOs, I think, are phenomenal in terms of their understanding of those local issues and how it works and so on. So I think it's a very valid consideration to start thinking about who and how we would engage. Now, of course, not all NGOs are so friendly and willing to collaborate, because there are some NGOs who are, of course, very aggressive. Yeah. And, you know, again, they're very passionate about what they do. So we have to be mindful of the fact that as part of our strategy, we need to decipher, well, who do we want to work with? Again, going back to what are our objectives as a company, and try and figure that out. But I think that, again, will be something that will change over the next few years in terms of how we understand who our stakeholders are in this, and how we collaborate, and how we're less likely to cover up issues and sort of talk industry-wide about the fact that, hey, we're all experiencing the same problem. So how can we collaborate to try and change things?
This has been such a great conversation, Ben. My takeaways, I've been circling them as we go along. I loved at the beginning, you said that really your role is helping people protect corporate value. Fantastic. I'm stealing that. And then the kind of two takeaways for practical things to do. First of all, map your risk. Get out there and figure out specifically what your profile looks like. Do a materiality assessment. Then figure out who to engage with and how to engage in the importance of NGOs. So please tell people how to continue this conversation with you if they're interested in getting help from you, from, of course, the company JS Held, or just continuing the dialogue. How do they get in touch with you?
Well, I'm on LinkedIn. You will find me. I'm more than happy to answer emails. So I'm not sure how we can do that, but my email address is bfouracre@jshel.com. And you know, you can find me on the JS Held website as well. And always very happy to take questions or listen to issues and try to have discussions about similar issues we've had perhaps and how we can support. But we're very, yeah, as an investigations firm, the way we're structured is to have global resource that can look into these issues. So if we have a Japanese company that's got operations in Vietnam, Thailand, Indonesia, wherever, we have teams on the ground that can investigate and look into those issues and look at local concerns and so on. So we'd be very happy to be involved if anyone has questions or issues. So thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to do this. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.